welcome you all to our second of our Fall 1999 IBRI Colloquium sessions. And let's start with a word of prayer. Father, we thank you for this chance to get together to think about things relating to your world and your word. We pray that you might guide Dave as he thinks about these things through for us and with us, that we might have a better understanding of who you are and what you're doing. We pray that you'd strengthen each one of us to know you better and to love you more. We pray you'd be with us now this evening and guide us in this time together. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. We're pleased this evening to have Dr. David C. Bossard speak to us on the subject of Day One and the Creation of Matter, a physicist view. Now, Bossard is cheating a little bit here. He's a mathematician, but an applied mathematician is kind of like a physicist. And you can't do physics if you can't do mathematics. So Dr. Bossard got his doctorate in mathematics from Dartmouth University, and then was working as a, systems analyst in private practice or something like that for the federal government down in the mainline area, and somehow ran into Biblical Theological Seminary and came to our evening school sessions before we gave degrees for those things, and then eventually wound up taking our MDiv program here. So we're glad to have him come back from his retirement up in New Hampshire and speak to us on the subject of Day One and the Creation of Matter, a physicist view.
Thank you, Bob. I'm going to talk about an interpretation of Genesis 1, and I don't want you to think that I am saying this is the absolute way of interpreting Genesis 1, but I'm trying to put on the hat of a physicist. I'm just sort of naively just looking at, at Genesis 1, Day 1 in particular. Let me just read Genesis 1, 1 to 5, and I'm reading from the NIV. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw that the light was good, and he separated the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. First, I'd like to say a little preliminary stuff about the ability to understand the natural world. It is surprising that we can learn as much as we have about the universe, and hence about a significant part of God's creation. A French philosopher, Auguste Comte, said in 1835, and I'll just read this one quote, "On the subject of stars, all investigations which are not ultimately reducible to simple visual observations are necessarily denied us. While we can conceive of the possibility of determining their shapes, their sizes, and their motions, we shall never be able by any means to determine their chemical composition or even their density." I suspect that many people today would agree with Comte. It does seem incredible that we could learn about things at such a distance. How could one learn about the makeup and physical characteristics of stars that are so far away? He really states what seems to be intuitively obvious. In this case, however, our intuition and Comte are exactly wrong. He said this less than 20 years before the first spectrum of hydrogen was measured by Angstrom in 1853. Although the physical interpretation of atomic spectra was not understood for another 75 years, it was very shortly after this date possible to analyze the composition of stars using spectral analysis. Now that scientists have a good grasp of how the atomic spectra came about, it is possible to go further and use spectral observations to show that the physical laws for atomic and nuclear processes here on Earth are the same physical laws throughout the universe. It is unexpected and surprising that we Earth-bound humans could reach so far in our understanding. Einstein once said, "Subtle is the Lord, but malicious he is not." When a colleague asked what he meant by that, he replied, "Nature hides her secret because of her essential loftiness, but not by means of a ruse." In the beginning, God in his wisdom created the laws of physics. These laws then led to the creation of the elements that form the heavens and the earth. These laws are subtle, yet they are accessible to human investigation to a remarkable degree. As Einstein observed, God does not try to fool us into thinking that things are different from what they really are. We do not yet understand all of these laws, but in the past century we have learned enough to sketch the outline of how God created the elements, and that is what I would like to discuss today. I do not mean to imply that God had to use natural physical laws to create the elements. He could have done it by merely speaking the word. But I do not believe that he chose that approach, because scientists have learned to read the early history of the universe almost as clearly as you can read a book. God is not malicious, and I do not believe he would have shown the story of creation with this degree of clarity if it were not essentially true, allowing, of course, for possible misreading of some of the details. I'd like to begin our story by pretending that we're physicists looking at the creation account in Genesis 1 for the first time. For the moment, assume we are just skimming the account to see how it compares with what our physical theories would say. We do this, and we are immediately struck by God's first statement in verse 3, "Let there be light." Wow, we think. That's exactly right. Light is the first thing created. Now, to understand what a physicist means when he says this, you must understand what light means to a physicist. Let me quote Richard Feynman, a Nobel laureate, from a lecture series he gave on light. "When I say light in these lectures, I don't mean simply the light we can see, from red to blue. It turns out that visible light is just part of a long scale that's analogous to a musical scale in which there are notes higher than you can hear and other notes lower than you can hear. The scale of light can be described by numbers called the frequency. And as the numbers get higher, the light goes from red to blue to violet to ultraviolet. We can't see ultraviolet light, but it can affect photographic plates. It's still light, only the number is different. If we change the number in the other direction, we go from blue to red to infrared, then television waves and radio waves. For me, all of that is light." So you see, Feynman, together with all other physicists, would visualize "let there be light" to mean far more than just "let the sun shine" or something similar. He and I would be at least tempted to read far more into such a statement, particularly one made at the very beginning of God's creative activity. Light, understood in the physicist's sense, is the most primitive form of energy. It is pure energy. Aside from light, energy can be bound up in mass and is exchanged between objects whenever they change velocity. But the purest form of energy is light. The heat that you feel from a fire or from infrared lamps is pure energy in the form of light, using the word as a physicist uses it. According to the physicist's view of creation, the universe began with the Big Bang, with the creation of a point of pure light, and expanded to become the universe we have today, creating in the process all the elements, the stars and the galaxies, and our own sun and earth. So to a physicist, it rings absolutely true that the Genesis creation account begins with the creation of light. Or at least that's God's first recorded command. Coming in verse 3, after some statements that seem to presume the existence of the elements, and perhaps even the earth, the narrative's order may be a bit puzzling, but nonetheless, the physicist is struck by the fact that the writer considered light to figure so prominently right at the start of the account. As he continues to read, the physicist is struck by the second thing that figures into the account, darkness, and the separation of light from darkness. What is this all about? He puzzles a bit, and then he realizes that, yes, that does make sense. He recalls a remark made by a physicist. "The darkness of the night skies has profound consequences for the development and continued existence of life." One of the things that physicists are not quite yet sure of is why, after starting out as a lump of light, the universe subsequently developed into galaxies and stars. In order for this to happen, there had to be irregularities, there had to be gaps in the intense light. Without these gaps, the universe would stay as one or a few big lumps of light and then collapse on itself. Without these gaps, we would not have the universe. Do these gaps relate to the darkness? And is the galaxy-making process the separation of light from darkness? Look at it negatively. If light had not been separated from darkness, then light would have collapsed on itself, and that would have been the end of creation. Note that the physicist up to this point is not thinking about the Earth or narrowing down the scope of the creation account to the Earth. He is thinking about the creation of the elements. Is it possible that the creation account has the same grand scheme in mind? Or does the account pass over the creation of the elements and start with a raw, empty, formless Earth? As the King of Siam would say, is a puzzlement, to which we will return later. But now let's see the Genesis account, set the Genesis account aside, and consider the physicist's account of the creation of the elements. The universe began as a point of light some 12 to 15 billion years ago, and has expanded since that time to its present size. We see the evidence of this creation, of this expansion, when we look at distant stellar objects, which appear to recede from us at rates that increase with their distance. By projecting backward in time from the present, we can estimate the time of the Big Bang, as it is called. Even though 15 billion years seems to be a lot, we will see that it is in fact a very moderate lapse of time to create the material world necessary for human existence. The elements were created in a series of six distinct stages. By analogy to the creation account of Genesis 1, let's call them the days in which God created the elements, using the word day to denote a pivotal stage in creation. Day 1, the creation of energy. And God said, let there be light. This day lasts from the beginning of time to 10 to the minus 43 seconds, which is a very short time. Physicists have a basic difficulty talking about day one because of quantum mechanics and general relativity. The two basic theories that concern the electrical and gravitational laws break down at such small dimensions. The diameter of the universe at the end of day one is called the Planck distance, and the time is called the Planck time. For distances and times less than this, it seems that there is no testable theory that can describe what happens because physics descends to random behavior. On day one, all the energy in the universe in the form of light was created. Truly, let there be light is an appropriate command to start the day. Everything is pure light, pure energy. There is no matter because the temperature is so high that the elements would melt quite literally and immediately go back to pure energy. Day two lasts from the end of day one to 10 to the minus 32 seconds, which is still a fairly short time. Rather shorter than I can measure on my clock, anyway. Two amazing things happen on day two. The first is inflation. For a brief period of time, the universe suddenly expands beyond anything we can imagine. It is as if a small dot suddenly blew up larger than the size of the present universe, except that it began as much smaller than a dot and exploded to something still small, about 340 centimeters. But well, 340 centimeters is about the width of this room, is that roughly? No, maybe not about two-thirds of the width of this room. About two-thirds of the width of this room. So you got the whole universe contained in this room. But the expansion was far faster than the speed of light during this time. Some physicists speculate that gravity briefly turned into a repulsive force. There does not appear to be any direct way to prove this by experimentation because the energies and temperatures are so far beyond anything that can be reproduced in any laboratory. One very important thing happened in this expansion. The uniform light that creation started with developed small rifts or ripples, which means that the universe was no longer a uniform smear of light, but had minor variations in light intensity. This was absolutely necessary so that at a much later time, millions of years later, in fact, stars, galaxies, and galaxy clusters would form. Without this expansion and ripping, the universe would have collapsed in on itself. We can see the remnants of these rips if we take that off temporarily, Brendan. If we make a three-dimensional map of the universe, the galaxies appear to lie along strings and in groups separated by large regions that are mostly empty. This is what's called a redshift map of significant sections of the universe where the distance here is redshift and you can see galaxies. These are
what I mean by strings of galaxies. And you look at one of those things, and you'll see billions of stars in any one of those dots. But you'll also see big gaps, huge gaps. There's this one right there, for example, where there appears to be nothing.
And this is characteristic of the what they call the maps, the redshift maps. There's another slide that I have to show you. That is a simulation of the same sort of thing. And it shows the picture that this black area is just the primordial slight irregularities, which go over the course of millions and billions of years to the strings we showed you before. And if you look close at one point in the string, you'll see galaxies in that little point there, wherever it's pointing to. And if you look at one of those galaxies, the galaxy might have a billion stars in it. We're talking fairly huge, more than I can count. So that's the characteristic of the universe today. You see these strings of galaxies, they're called galaxy clusters, with voids in between them that are kind of empty. I'd like to share a little skit to illustrate the importance of this step in the creation of the elements. And we have three characters in the skit. We have God here. We have Ariel, and I'm the narrator. God is ready to begin the creation. His angels want to help, especially one particularly precocious angel named Ariel. So God explains to Ariel that the first thing that must be created is light, because all of matter is built out of light. He tells Ariel that there are lots of other details that you have to look after, but you have to start with light. Ariel was a little mischievous and a bit impatient. So he says to himself, "This sounds exciting. I'm going to try it for myself. Won't God be pleased when he sees how much I have learned from this little talk?" So Ariel goes off and creates a universe. Bang! He makes the light just as God said he had to. Just then, God drops in.
"I tried what you said. Look at it."
God looks at the universe that Ariel just created.
"That's a nice job, Ariel. Afraid it won't work."
"Well, why won't it work? I created light, just like you said."
"You need darkness in your universe."
"Darkness? What do you mean, darkness? Darkness is nothing. Nothing is made out of darkness. You mean to have light to create anything. You said so yourself."
"You need darkness."
"You talk as if darkness is something, but darkness is nothing. You can't create matter out of darkness."
"Well, Ariel, you did a good job with your light. Let's just watch and see what happens."
So God and Ariel sat down and watched Ariel's new universe. It started expanding from the microscopic point of intense light that Ariel had made. It grew and grew, and then started to collapse. When it started collapsing, everything was over in a minute. Ariel's universe had self-destructed.
"What happened?"
"You need darkness."
"Well, God, I guess I need to learn something more about creating universes. Why do I need darkness?"
"You need to have many areas of darkness spread all through the light, because the gravity in light makes it come together in clumps. In your universe, there was no darkness, so all the light just collapsed into a point, and poof, there went your universe. If you want, let's say, two clumps of light, then you have to have some darkness between the two clumps, so the light in each clump will be attracted mostly to the rest of the light in its own clump, and not the light in the other clump. Of course, you need lots of clumps, so you need clumps small enough so that you'll be able to produce useful kinds of matter. But that's another story. You can't get anywhere with your universe unless you can get the great mass of light that you created to separate into clumps. For that, you need darkness. Not the darkness outside of your universe, but darkness in your universe, mixed in with the light. You were right that darkness is nothing. You can't make matter out of darkness, but you need darkness anyway. You need to separate light from darkness, or else you can't get started with your creation. I think I'll tell that to Moses."
"Who's Moses?"
As I said, two things happened on day two. The second is that the universe cooled during the expansion, so that a lot of energy condensed into quarks. What are quarks? Quarks are the building blocks of protons and neutrons. They were discovered and named in 1970 by the physicist Gell-Mann. A proton has two up quarks and one down quark, and a neutron has two down quarks and one up quark. An up quark has a charge of 2/3 of an electron volt, and a down quark has a charge of -1/3. If you add the charges of the three quarks, you find the proton charge is +1, and the neutron charge is 0, as it should be. One peculiar feature of quarks is that they experience the strong force. This is a different force from gravity and electromagnetism. The difference is this. The force of gravity, or electricity, between two objects gets less as the objects move away from each other. But the strong force between two quarks gets greater as they move apart, something like a stretched rubber band. Because of this strong force, quarks like to be squashed really close together. So they were very happy during day two. But as the universe expanded, the strong force caused what is about to happen on day three. But that's not the end of the story of day two, and the rest is even more amazing. When pure energy condenses, it forms pairs of quarks and antiquarks, so that the universe is filled with matter and antimatter in equal amounts. When matter and antimatter collide, they mutually annihilate into a burst of light energy. But for some reason, it appears that quarks are very slightly more stable than antiquarks. That is, antiquarks tend to self-destruct slightly more often than quarks. So that by the time the quarks find antiquarks to mutually annihilate, there aren't quite as many around. By the end of day two, there is about one quark left for every 300 million quarks that were originally formed in pairs. All the antimatter is destroyed, and what is left is the quarks that form the matter that we have today. That's why we don't have antimatter around today. All of this happened on day two. And by the end of this day, the universe consists of light energy, free quarks, and free electrons. There are no elements. Quarks can exist alone only at the densities and temperatures that existed during day two. Now let's go on to day three. Now this day three lasts from 10 to the minus 32 seconds to 1 second. So now we're getting into times we can actually think about. So at the end of day three, it'll be 1 second into the creation. As the creation days pass, the universe becomes larger, less hot, and less dense. The cooling allows more stable structures to appear. During day three, the quarks combine to form protons and neutrons. All of the free quarks combine in this way so that there are no quarks left by themselves. Protons are hydrogen atoms with the electrons stripped away. It's still far too hot for the protons to capture and hold a neutron or an electron, so no proper elements yet exist. At this point, the temperature is dropped to a level that can be reproduced in some high-energy colliders that are used by physicists today. Therefore, it's possible to study the details of the nuclear interactions that occur from here on through the remaining days of creation. So from day three on, we are now in the realm where high-energy colliders and so forth can actually test the theories of what happens. Day four. Day four is the creation of hydrogen and helium. And this day lasts to 3 minutes after the creation, after the Big Bang. On day four, the temperature of the universe has cooled enough that some atomic nuclei can form from combinations of protons and neutrons. Deuterium, which has one proton and one neutron, helium-3, two protons and one neutron, and helium-4. To show the next diagram, I believe it's they come together. This shows two protons coming together, but you could have a proton and a neutron come together to form a proton-neutron pair, which is a deuterium atom. And then another proton would come in to form a helium-3, and then, two helium-3s come together to form helium-4, and then two protons are kicked off. And that's the kind of reaction that would occur during day four. It's still too hot for these nuclei to hold electrons, so they're just bare nuclei called ions. The formation of proper elements is still in the future. The nuclei created on day four will become the primordial elements. They're called primordial because of the elements that are created right at the beginning. Almost all of the ordinary matter in the universe today is primordial. 91% of all atoms in the universe are hydrogen, and 8.9% of all the atoms in the universe are helium. All the other elements, carbon, oxygen, all the way through to uranium, amount only to 0.15, about a tenth of a percent of all the atoms in the universe, or anything other than hydrogen and helium. Most of the hydrogen and helium is primordial, although there, in some of the processes we'll discuss, you can actually produce helium or hydrogen as a byproduct, but most of the hydrogen and helium in the universe are primordial. Next day, day five. Day five now goes from 300,000 years after the creation to the present time. Between 3 minutes and 300,000 years, nothing happens much. The universe cools and expands, but atoms can still not form because the radiation intensity is too high to allow hydrogen and helium nuclei to hold on to their electrons. There are no stars, and in fact, gravitational forces are hardly noticeable because of the much higher electrical forces that occur between ions and electrons. It's like if the reason you have two charged things, and they might have some mass, but the mass is insignificant compared with the charge. And so that the gravitational force just doesn't play because they're either attracted or repelled by electrical forces. But beginning about 300,000 years after creation, the temperature of the universe has dropped to the point that electrons can attach to the nuclei. The temperature is about 3,000 degrees at 300,000 years, and 3,000 degrees is like the temperature of molten iron, I think. Somewhere, you know, when you form iron in a blast furnace, your temperatures are roughly 3,000 degrees. So we're talking about the universe at 300,000 years has cooled to the point where it is now about the temperature of molten iron. And at that point, stable atoms can appear. The temperature at the start of this day is about the temperature of very hot fire. The atoms are electrically neutral, so that when enough atoms have formed, we now can have gravitational forces be felt, and the atoms begin to cluster into galaxies and stars. By about a billion years after the Big Bang, galaxies and stars are beginning to be produced in abundance. Some of these primordial galaxies can be viewed by the Hubble telescope. Once stars begin to form, the production of the light elements begins. The stars are the place where the elements up to iron are formed by the process of thermonuclear fusion. Fusion occurs when lighter elements combine to form a heavier element. We just saw the case of hydrogen combining to form helium. And in the process, excess energy is released. This burning of the lighter elements can take place if the heavier element has a mass that is slightly less than the combined mass of the elements that went into it. That's how the hydrogen bomb works. In the hydrogen bomb, you'll have deuterium, which is a certain weight. Two of them form a helium, which is slightly less than the sum of the masses of the two deuterium. Okay, and that slightly less, that difference, is energy that is kicked out and then in the reaction. In the case of stars, both hydrogen and helium provide much of the fuel. A typical mature star has concentric layers in which different stages of fusion occur. This would be an example of a mature star. It starts off with all hydrogen and helium, and gradually the hydrogen and helium form together to form carbon. They burn to form carbon, then into oxygen. And because those are slightly more massy, they tend to gravitate towards the center. And you go on up the scale, up to iron, and iron is the iron group is the highest group that can be formed by fusion. Because beyond the iron group, iron is about a third of the way down the periodic table. Beyond the iron group, when you put two lighter things together to form a heavier thing, it actually sucks up energy instead of releasing it. And so you can't sustain a reaction that's sucking up energy. The reason the stars burn is because they release energy, okay? And that'll work up to iron. So in this day, we can form anything up to iron. Thermonuclear reactions cannot start unless the temperature is high enough so that neutral atoms, particularly helium, can collide with enough energy to force the nuclei together, temperatures in the order of millions of degrees. It is ironic that this combination could not occur earlier when the universe was very hot, but when that was the case, the atoms were ionized, and the electrical force of repulsion was too much to overcome. But on this day five, the helium atoms are neutral. They're gathered together in stars, pressed together by gravitational force. So the stars heat up, nucleosynthesis begins, and then the heat of fusion keeps it going. Starting with hydrogen and helium, we end up with iron. Day six, creation of the heavy elements, solar system. The typical time for stars to pass through their complete cycle, beginning with helium and producing a core of iron and nickel, is on the order of a billion years. Some very heavy stars younger than that. When a star reaches the end of its life, some of them explode in a cataclysmic event called a supernova. What happens is that the central core that is producing iron uses up its available fuel, and so it's burned out. And the explosive force of the thermonuclear reactions then die out, which leaves a vacuum at the center of the star. Gravitational forces cause the rest of the star to collapse, heat up suddenly, and then explode. Literally in the space of a second to a few minutes, an entire star erupts with a vast release of radiation energy, predominantly neutrons and high-energy light called gamma rays. The intense neutron radiation bombards the debris of the star and forms the elements heavier than iron, using the radiation energy to provide the energy needed to force them together, a sort of reverse atom bomb. The explosive energies in the supernova are so great that some remnants that can be seen today still have radiation temperatures in excess of 10 million degrees hundreds of years after the supernova. Supernovas can make a spectacular display in the sky, and I want to show you a few pictures. The first one is the Crab Nebula, the first two, actually. That's the Crab Nebula. Obviously, it's not visible like that to the naked eye, but if you use a telescope of appropriate size, it looks like that. It is the remnant of a supernova that appeared on July 4th, 1054 AD. And at the time, it was about a distance of 5,000 light years from the Earth. This supernova was recorded by Chinese astronomers. It was visible to the naked eye during daylight for 3 weeks. And what we see now is about 1,000 years of expansion from that supernova. And there are temperatures in there still in excess of 10 million degrees. And 10 million degrees is fairly hot. And this is radiation temperature from the ambient radiation, which means that temperature can be used to form heavier elements. Okay?
Yes. Just for a reference, how hot does the hydrogen bomb get? Or neutron?
The center of the sun is about five to ten million, something like that. The hydrogen bomb, I could presume, would get in the order of millions of degrees. Yeah, I'm not sure. No, I think for hydrogen, it's about 2 or 3 million, two, three, four million, something like that. And then as you go heavier in the scale, the temperature has to go higher. So I think it's around 2 to 4 million for a hydrogen bomb. But anyway, here's the next picture is another picture of the supernova. And incidentally, these came out of the internet, as you can probably see. And you can have a wonderful time looking at beautiful pictures on the internet. But just type in supernova, at least if you have Netscape, type in supernova, and you'll see thousands of pictures. Here's another picture of the thing in a certain... So what they do is they take pictures in certain frequency ranges. I think this is an X-ray. I believe this is an X-ray picture, which means very high temperature. The shorter the wavelength, the X-rays are very high temperature. If it was visible light, it would be, moderate temperature. X-rays are very hot temperature. Infrared would be very low temperature. So this shows there's a lot of very hot stuff in the Crab Nebula. I'd like to show you another one. In 1987, the first supernova visible to the naked eye in nearly 400 years. Now, I tried to track it down on the internet today to check that because I heard two conflicting numbers. One was 250. I think the last supernova visible was at Atomic Kepler, which is about 400 years. Yeah. So for a long time, nobody saw a supernova. In 1987, there was a real supernova. And if you look at this lower picture, this is a before, looking at the region, and after. There's the supernova right there. So you can see the before and after picture. Scientists had the opportunity to watch the thing right from the beginning, from even before it was. A wonderful event. This particular supernova was about 160,000 light years away. There have been 9 visible supernovas since the time of Christ. So they're not very common. Okay? They're not real common. It was really a wonderful thing to have seen one in 1987. They arrived about every 250 years or so. The supernovas cause the debris of the star to be scattered around. The bulk of this debris is unburned helium and hydrogen, together with all the lighter elements produced in the star. A new cycle of star formation then begins. These are called the second generation stars. The solar system and the sun are both made out of the debris of first generation stars. Thus, the elements of the Earth were once formed in the hearts of first generation stars, and the sun itself is a second-generation star made up of the same debris. This one shows the 1987 in the context of the Magellanic Cloud. The Magellanic Cloud is a constellation that you can see in the southern hemisphere. It's sort of like a fog of stars in the southern hemisphere, and there's the supernova. Uranium and other heavy elements are formed at the time of the supernovas that provide the material for the solar system. Many of these elements are unstable and break down into lighter elements. For example, uranium breaks down into a series of radioactive products that end up in lead. The breakdown is called fission. By studying the amount of these products found in ore that is rich in uranium or other radioactive heavy elements, it's possible to estimate the age of the sun in the solar system, and that's the basis for asserting that the solar system and the Earth are about 4.5 billion years old. It's based on the fact that the uranium that is observed in its decay products indicate that the uranium was originally created about 4.5 billion years ago, and presumably in supernovas. The creation of the Earth and the solar system are the endpoint and the purpose of the creation of the elements. The total time from the Big Bang allows time for some early first and second generation stars to form and mature, forming the debris that became the second generation sun and the Earth. So from the viewpoint of the creation of the universe, a habitable Earth appears nearly as soon as the raw materials were available. This ends the physicist's story of the creation of the physical elements. There are a number of places in the story where success depended on things working out just so. We don't have time to look at those, but the interested person might consult some other books by Hugh Ross, and there's a classic Barrow and Tipler. I'd like to now go back to the Genesis text. We have now come full circle. We started out just skimming a part of Genesis 1 with the eye of a physicist, and then we went on to describe a physicist's view of how matter was created. So now we see we're all budding physicists. We can see things as a physicist would see them. So let's go back to Genesis with this more complete understanding. When we looked at Genesis earlier, we kind of jumped in at verse 3 and latched onto that remarkable command, "Let there be light." We did this without particularly considering how the creation account is usually read. In the most common reading of Genesis 1, the creation of the elements is all over by the time we get to verse 3. In fact, verse 2 seems to talk of the earth as something that already exists, albeit formless and empty. Since we physicists were so impressed with verse 3, we'd like to be able to interpret verse 2 in some way that did not imply that the earth was already in existence. Do we have any basis for such an interpretation? Well, yes. It may come as something of a surprise to you, it did to me, that there was a discussion over 1,500 years ago about the meaning of verse 2, which came to a conclusion that is quite consistent with the idea that verse 3 describes the first act of creation. Since this discussion was long before modern science came onto the stage, long before the physical significance of light was known, it can hardly be argued that this is after-the-fact exegesis. The original discussion was by St. Augustine around 400 A.D. and is cited in a discussion of question 66 of the Summa Theologica written by St. Thomas Aquinas around 1250. Aquinas argues, the relevant point is found in the first article, quote, whether informity of created matter preceded in time its formation. In other words, was matter non-existent before it was created? You may say with some merit that this sounds like yet another of those angels dancing on the heads of pins type of questions that was so popular among medieval theologians. But the interesting thing about it is that in the process of answering the question, Aquinas discusses the proper meaning of the statement in verse 2 that the NIV translates as, "Now the earth was formless and empty." Aquinas asks, what is the meaning of earth, and what is the intent of the phrase, formless and empty? He argues, citing St. Augustine, that earth may refer to matter, not to the planet, or whatever he would call this thing we stand on. As to the word earth referring to matter, you may realize that for some time before the time of Aristotle and through the Middle Ages, it was thought that there are four elements, earth, water, fire, and air. It was thought that the different kinds of earth, all of the solids, differ due to their form, that is, different construction, but not in their essence. form distinguishes matter. I do not know how ancient this concept is, or whether, for example, a Hebrew physicist would think of things in that way. Neither Plato nor Aristotle take credit for originating the idea, though. Of course, the modern view is that some kinds of matter do indeed differ only in form. For example, diamonds and charcoal are both carbon. But other kinds of matter differ in essence, as iron differs from copper, for example. Aquinas remarked, the word earth is taken differently in this passage by Augustine and by other writers. Augustine holds that by the words earth and water in this passage, primarily matter itself is signified, for it was impossible for Moses to make the idea of such matter intelligible to an ignorant people, except under the similitude of well-known things. In this respect, then, the earth is said to be void and empty, or invisible and shapeless, because matter is known by means of form. Hence, considered in itself, it is called invisible or void, and its potentiality is filled by form. But other holy writers understand by earth the element earth, that is, one of the four elements. Aquinas argues that actual matter has not yet been created in verse 2, but only its potentiality. And that is what is meant by formless and empty, a phrase that Augustine translates invisible and shapeless. With either translation, the phrase is a way of saying that the earth was not yet created, whether meaning the physical earth or meaning matter in general. And Aquinas recognized both meanings as possible. Incidentally, before the talk tonight, I went up and looked in the TDOT, the Theological Dictionary of the Old Testament, and looked up the word tohu, which is translated empty. And very interesting. You look up that word, and I won't even spill the beans, but you look up that word in the TDOT, and you see the various ways it could be interpreted. For example, one verse says the earth hangs on tohu. The earth hangs on nothing. From the viewpoint of modern physics, some misunderstandings about the nature of matter can be seen in Aquinas' argument. But the point I would like to make is that he argues that the description of verse 2 is a picture of things before creation began. That is impressive, because it is exactly what is implied by the physicists wanting to jump right to verse 3. Our physicists did it because of the command, let there be light, which matches exactly with what happened in the Big Bang. Aquinas did it for different reasons. Frankly, I don't know how the original readers would have understood the words earth, deep, and waters in verse 2. I see the word earth, and I think of the third rock from the sun. Very likely, the original reader would not have seen the word in the same way. But I don't know how the original readers understood the nature of matter, whether or not they thought in terms of four elements, as Aristotle did, and whether they placed special significance on form to distinguish different kinds of matter, as Aquinas implies. I do know that for most of recorded history, these words were not understood as we see them now. I just don't know how an ancient Hebrew physicist would have explained them. But Aquinas' argument that formless denotes the absence of objective existence does make considerable sense to me, and it is certainly consistent with an interpretation that begins creation at verse 3. Incidentally, the phrase formless and empty only appears one other time in the Bible, and that's in Jeremiah, where it's referring right back to this same verse. So you don't get much help from the usage of the phrase in the Bible. Here is a suggestion, which I happen to believe is correct. Verse 2 describes a vision of the indescribable emptiness and the vacuous void of the cosmos before there was a cosmos. The earth is just matter. Darkness, of course, before there was light. The deep is the unfathomable expanse of emptiness. The waters in parallel with the earth, fluid nothingness. And then God said, let there be light. Such a script would lead to our physicist's starting view that this command starts everything. We are treated to descriptions of the indescribable at other places in the Bible. Ezekiel's description of the throne of God, John's description of the same thing in Revelation, Daniel's descriptions of his visions. In these places you can see the author struggling to express in words to human readers something that is totally beyond comprehension in its awesomeness and majesty. I don't see the need to call the readers ignorant, as Augustine apparently did. Perhaps this is just a dubious translation. any more than one would say that Ezekiel or John were ignorant. We are dealing with indescribable things. Therefore, in our reading of verse 2, we have to give allowance for this struggle, just as we have to recognize that any artist's attempt to depict the vision of John's vision of the Lamb with seven horns and seven eyes would be a grotesque parody of a glorious scene. The words taken literally do not do full justice to the scene, and so they must be read as an inspired attempt to describe a scene, but one that is hampered by the limitations of human language and experience. In conclusion, I suggest that perhaps the events of day one really were the first creation events, and that verses 1 and 2 refer to the indescribable scene prior to the first creation event, the creation of life. References in these verses to earth, water, and the deep are words used to describe this scene and do not refer to earth, water, and the oceans as we know them. I don't suggest this dogmatically, or even as a necessary interpretation to reconcile the account in Genesis with the physicist's account. But such an interpretation would give new meaning to the statement, "Let there be light." And in view of what the physicists understand, I think a new look at the meaning of this command is warranted. I would like to close with an observation of how the biblical view of creation differs from the usual secular view. Both views, of course, have a creation, whether it is by God or not. The essential difference is that the Bible says that creation involves two ingredients, light and wisdom. This view is repeated again and again throughout the Bible. The secular view, if you interpret light as meaning energy more in the physicist sense, the secular view is that creation involves only one ingredient, light. The presumption in the secular view is that the laws of physics are eternal and need no creator, or else that this is just one of an infinity of universes with all sorts of different physical laws, and that the subtle features that make our particular universe work are just happenstance. We wouldn't be here to discuss them unless they worked out. There is an irreconcilable difference between these views. The secular scientist is not going to admit the need for wisdom, regardless of the evidence, and the biblical student is not going to give it up. But the voice that goes out into all the earth is still there, and I believe there will always be some who hear that voice and will heed the dwelling of the Holy Spirit to make the appropriate conclusions. Thank you. Everybody is totally befuddled or shocked, ready to call the council now to.
I just had a couple of questions that I thought of. You mentioned on day two, you showed some diagrams of sort of strings of stars.
Yes.
I've seen that represented as sort of the idea that if you want to do it in three dimensions as bubbles and sort of the stars on the surface of bubbles.
I don't have a three-dimensional screen here, unfortunately.
Sort of that picture there. But you also mentioned briefly that physicists have proposed that for some brief time, gravity may have been repulsive as opposed to that. Can you elaborate on that in any way?
No. That's one of the gut theories, grand unified theories, which says that there was a time. We now have four forces. I have mentioned three of them. We have the electromagnetic force, gravitational force, the strong force, and a weak force, which I haven't mentioned. Okay, there was a time in the past when these four forces combined to one force. And somewhere in the machinations of that combination, according to somebody's theory, there was, whether, I don't know whether it's, there had to be or there could have been a negative gravitational force at one point. You're talking about, Gell-Mann came in 1970. I got my PhD in 67, so I don't know. I was already over the hill before he, yes, sir.
Yes. Well, it may be dangerous to speculate, but as an electrical engineer, when you start taking solid-state physics, they tell you that a hole in a, in a semiconductor crystal is the absence of an electron.
Yes.
And then when you get into it deeper, maybe toward graduate school, you learn that they lied to you because it's important in education. creatively lied.
Otherwise, you'd never know anything, right?
And then the hole was an electron in the, if I remember correctly, it was in the conduction band with negative mass.
Yes.
So it wouldn't be, anyhow, having gone through that experience, it wouldn't surprise me if there's something gravity would be revolting.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing is, I mean, because I was way behind the eight ball, even starting this thing out, I've spent about two years just reading as much as I possibly could. I mean, I don't mean I'm a genius. I mean, I just read as much as I could, which means limited by what I can understand, perhaps, or maybe even more than that. And all I can say is that one could say that was the finger of God, okay, that did that. All I'm saying is there is a theory that that was negative gravity. As far as I know, there is no way in the world to prove that with physical experiments, because we're talking about energies that are way beyond anything we could even possibly think of producing in a laboratory, okay? So that means that those kinds of theories have to be theories, okay? But the fact is, we have galaxies. That's the interesting fact. And how do you get from galaxies, from a point of pure light? You had to somehow have rips occur. And that's how the theory comes up. Now, I don't know enough about the gut, with all the GUT theories, to give an authoritative statement of exactly how they come by the notion of negative gravity. I do know that the GUT theories, the person who started off with these theories was just paging through a math book looking for strange formulas that might possibly explain what he's seeing, and he found things called beta functions which seem to have the right properties. And so that was the basis of the GUT theory. I mean, not like Einstein, who basically started with first principles and derived some things. The gut theories, that as far as I know, started with somebody looked at a book, and here's a nice equation, seems to have some very nice properties. And so I don't know what the real physical underpinnings are. If you read a book about the first 3 minutes or something, or some of the books I have here, I've got a number of books that are sort of more or less layman's level, more or less. And one of them is called The First 3 Minutes or something like that. That's a good one. And they talk about that sort of stuff. Yes?
You care to speculate on the end of the world? A big explosion?
You mean a whimper or a bang?
Are you giving that answer?
The answer is, I think the end of the world will be ended by God's fiat, not by natural processes. There is one of the books that I quote in my references is called The Five Ages of the Universe, which talks about, we're only in the second age of the universe, I believe. And there's still, you know, hundreds of billions of years to go or something like that. In fact, more than that. If things went by the natural processes, but I don't think that's going to happen. I think God's going to end the universe by fiat. I don't think it's going to because it starts collapsing. You know, it's not going to be the reason. Yes?
What would a secular physicist say that your point of light came from? What
is it for? The answer is they don't know. That's one point I mentioned, that some people say, well, maybe there are just billions of universes all over the place, and they just sort of pop up, and we're just one of those universes that happen to have the right physical laws. The next question is, where do we get these physical laws from? And the answer is they have no answer for that either. Yeah.
The difference between theoretical view and particular view was the wisdom. Yeah, and what role do you think the wisdom plays in the first, let's say, 3 minutes or
hours? Very good question. And the answer is, I don't know. Because what I haven't talked about is the subtleties that are involved in these laws to make things work out. Now, you could say the wisdom was in the formulation of the laws, and then they worked themselves out. Or you could say the wisdom required some tweaking, like, for example, in the expansion phase. I just don't know. And I don't think there's any way you're going to know. Now, when you get down to the creation of life, I think it's a totally different situation. But we're not talking about the creation of life today. We're just talking about the creation of elements. But it is, you know, whenever you confront a secular scientist, it's going to hit on that point. The secular scientist is going to claim that everything happened just by the random evolution or random chance from some physical laws, which came from who knows where.
If you're referring to creation of light, and you have to skip with Excel, by the way, but there's a point where a lot of people have problems with physicists. I was an astrophysicist in college, but they often had trouble with creation ex nihilo. And Hawkins got into all kinds of things with antimatter is existing, something always existed even before the time went off. My point is, though, that I've been thinking about this a lot, though. In your view, does that mean that God created darkness? He didn't technically create ex nihilo, he created darkness. And then,
It would be taken care of if, in fact, gravity did have a negative force for a period of time. I mean, you know, that's creation. I mean, that's still God's wisdom, whether he uses a law or whether he does it by some hands-on process, whatever hands-on means, but it's talking about God. But people like Hawking and so forth, they just don't want to believe in God. It's about as simple as that. But their alternative hypotheses are equally implausible, as far as I can see. They just don't make sense either. Yes?
I just think that in verse 2, in Genesis 1-2 here, right before God's statement about what they'll be like, we have a picture here of the Spirit of God moving over the surface of the water. So we have this idea of an interaction, a direct presence and motion, and the idea of movement within whatever this...
Whatever it is, yes.
You know, whatever's happening there. I mean, you know, one might start with that point and think through the idea of maybe a link to wisdom here, or even the idea of a breath of God creating the ripples in light, however that might...
Whatever, yeah.
I'm just simply saying that we see God's presence there, even with your analysis here, and jumping to verse 3 and look at that, we see God actively involved, you know, prior to that statement in some mechanism.
Existed
at the very instant of...
In the skit, I was trying to make the point in a humorous way that separation of light from darkness was an important part. If you interpret it in the sense of, you know, putting voids in the light, which the fact is, physicists today are still very puzzled, I believe, in general, with exactly how the galaxies form. I mean, you know, because it seems strange. I mean, you get all this energy, but in order to form the elements, you have to basically have only a little bit of energy. You know, you can't have an awful lot of mass. If you have too much mass, it won't work right. I mean, things have got to be just right. Now, whether that is because of very subtle natural laws or whether it's because God actually intervened in some way, I'm willing to say it's subtle laws. In fact, if I was a physicist, I'd try my best to try to find those subtle laws. I wouldn't say, well, I'm not going to worry about it because maybe God just did it just by fiat, which is good, you know. But my job as a physicist is to try to find the laws if I can, and then submit them to experimental verification, and then use that route to go. Yes.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that this statement in Isaiah 45:7. I don't have my Hebrew Bible, so I'm not sure. It does say, "I form light and create darkness."
Great. Okay. Yeah. Form light and create darkness. That's Isaiah 45:7. That sounds good. I'll have to look that up. And I also just came across, as I said, I just came across the citation to Job 26:7 about hanging the earth on nothing, which is exactly the word as void, formless and void. Well, give me that reference again.
Isaiah 45:7.
Okay, I'm going to look that up. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Yes.
I just want to make a point then. I think a lot of secular physicists would say they don't know what happens when you get back past 10 minus 42 seconds, whatever. They wouldn't all believe that they have the philosophy all worked out in the physics all world, that they can say, no, we didn't need God and it fluctuated out of vacuum.
That's right. We don't know.
We don't know.
We don't. That's exactly right. Physicists are much more modest than biologists.
I read that, if I understand it right, he's, I guess, kind of credited with exegeting an ex nihilo creation.
Who is this?
Augustine.
Augustine, a creation from the... Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Because if I understand, the questions that Aquinas was addressing are really esoteric philosophical things, but I'm not even sure I understand them. In fact, I sent an email to a Catholic Thomist theologian to ask for some, to verify that my interpretation of this question was correct. And I haven't gotten the answer back yet, so maybe everything I'm telling you is a lie. The issue, I believe, that Thomas Aquinas, in citing back to Augustine, was the earth formed out of really nothing, or was verse 2 was there something before there was the earth, you know, that sort of thing, some raw material of some sort that it came out of. And the interesting thing was, in that course of discussion, if I interpret Aquinas correctly, what he said was, no, verse 2 is a way of trying to explain, describing a state of nothingness, you know, to the readers, a state of whatever that is, you know, an indescribable thing, trying to describe it indescribable. Yes?
You talk about supernovas a lot, and you were saying about how rare they are. Would you say four within?
Rare, visible supernovas. There are supernovas all the time. In fact, I think for the last several years there have been, there's sort of a catalog of supernovas as they're being discovered, and there are some hundreds a year that are being discovered by telescope, as opposed to supernovas visible to the eye. There have been nine visible to the eye in the last 2,000 years.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, I think related to the Big Bang, you may correct me this afternoon, there's a prediction of one every 50 years is supposed to fit within the Big Bang theory, is that correct?
I think it's an estimate for our galaxy or something like that. A lot of our galaxies can't see.
Yes. Oh, yes. So you're saying, in other words, supernovas that would be relevant to the formation of something like the Earth. I mean, you know, for example, these two supernovas we saw in 1987 is 300,000 light years away. You know, so maybe that wouldn't be relevant to the formation of the matter for making an Earth. But within a galaxy, I think I've seen numbers something like that. About in a galaxy, about every 50 years or so, there will be a supernova.
Oh, I'm sorry, one more question. It's already become very interesting, and I'm wondering your opinion. I did research at 1405 megahertz on Cas A.
Yeah.
Me and my colleague found an apparent slowdown in the rate of increase of energy and expansion. And
they're beyond me.
To this topic with the element formation, I'm interested in having it. Yeah, because I've been trying to wrestle with that too when you were mentioning about how there's like a cauldron for elements creating. You say something to that effect that they're creating elements with it.
The light elements are created in the stars up through iron. For elements heavier than iron, you need to have a heavy radiation environment. Now, there is actually 2, 3, 4 different mechanisms, one of which is neutron bombardment, and that's the easiest to understand because you have very high-energy neutrons, I mean a very high temperature, very high-energy neutrons hitting something, and you have a new element, okay? Neutrons are nice because they're not subject to the electrical force, which usually keeps charged particles away from each other. But there are 2 or 3 other methods, and incidentally, a good list of the entire sequence is... In astrophysical formulas, Lang's astrophysical
for that, that's true, because I wrestled with this, and I ended up, I was encouraged to publish it, but I ended up doing further research.
Yeah.
And I'm not trying to talk about myself here, I'm sorry, I'm just making a point here, trying to get your opinion, because I don't know. A Russian scientist came up with the idea for that, Cas A, but I'm so sure how I would relate that to you. How would that be the point? How would you see that if there is an actual
point? Well, the next question is, how... do we care about the heavy elements? Are they necessary for life, for example? Because ultimately, my lectures are trying to get down to the question is, what is life? And there are a few elements heavier than iron that are necessary for life. Iodine, for example. Again, off the top of my head, think of what the other ones are. And so the question has to come, well, how would they have been formed typically? Now, I'm just quoting what somebody says as to how you get the heavy elements, and to me, a very useful manual was Lang's astrophysical formula, which takes every element and says what is the typical way that this is formed, and it has about 10 classes of formation. One, nuclear bombardment. There are other radiation type things. And so forth. Yes. Yeah. Okay. That it? Yeah.
Are you familiar with any evidence of light slowing?
No. I do not believe it for a minute. I do not believe that the speed of light is slowing. And the reason I don't believe it is because of spectral analysis. Because the spectral lines, if you analyze how spectral lines are formed, the spectral frequencies you get are intimately tied to the speed of light at the place where they are formed. And if there was a change in the speed of light with time or distance, you would expect to see the hydrogen spectrum look different far out than nearby, and it doesn't. That's why, that's what I was getting at when I was saying the amazing thing about this is that we are able to even look at the physics way far away, because understanding the spectral line generation, how it comes, will even tell you things about the physics at the place where it is formed, which is, to me, amazing. I mean, I just, who would have thought, you know? But I think that indicates that God really wants us to know about his universe.
Are you saying the speed of light cannot be? We cannot focus the speed of light.
And the speed of light in a vacuum is the same everywhere in the universe. A speed of light does change in a medium. For example, that's where you get the bending of light rays. That's because of a change in the speed of light. But that's not in a vacuum. We're talking about speed of light in the presence of other material. Yeah.
I just want to say that I think a picture like the one you're drawing is one that most scientists who are Christians come to. In understanding Genesis, we say,
yeah,
you know, there's the religionists and there are the secular physicists, and people that I know who are both Christians and who are scientists of some sort, they come to a picture pretty naturally, something like the one that you're drawing, both of the physics and then let's go on through the rest of Genesis.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, that's why I said let's start just looking at a physicist at Genesis 1 and see what happens. Because I think the natural way for a physicist to look at Genesis, the first day of creation, is the way I described it. The natural way. Now, whether that's the correct interpretation is another question for theologians and so forth to complain about or argue about. But, yes.
Yeah. I also want to say that I think that a picture like this one and drawn through the biological part of Genesis is consistent with assuming the Genesis account is still true. Whereas if you look at all the other ancient accounts, for instance, of creation and stuff that involve turtles and things like that, they're nonsense. And from the scientist's perspective, Genesis is amazing for when it was written and with what those people knew naturally at the time, for what it tells you about the order of events and light being first and all that kind of stuff. It's truly remarkable.
I think it is absolutely phenomenal, and it, to me, it's a strong indication of the divine origin of the text. That how could ancient... In fact, you know, I read somebody's description of physics from 50 years ago, and you can poke holes in it all over the place. So, I mean, normally you would expect that you take a document that's 3,000 years old, that you could poke holes through it all over the place. And wouldn't make any sense at all, you would think. but the Bible does make sense. And that, to me, that is an indication of its divine origin.